Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. According to news reports, the U.S. economy is back and will grow in the coming year. The positive economic outlook we often hear about in the media is based on indicators like consumer spending, the booming real estate market, and the stock market ending in a record year. CBS's MarketWatch reports that, quote, 2013 is looking to be a memorable year for investors. The S&P 500 is up 29% so far, on pace for its best year since 1997. The Dow is up 26%, its best year since 1996, end quote. But at the same time, millions of people are still looking for work. The official unemployment rate is 7%. Last weekend, 1.3 million people without jobs lost their unemployment benefits. And over the course of next year, several million more people will hit the 26-week limit and will also lose benefits. According to the administration, by the end of 2014, almost 5 million people will have been affected. And we've got inequality reaching new highs. 48 million people are on food stamps. So what is the real picture? On today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by taking a look at how the U.S. economy performed this year and what we should expect in 2014. Today, we're joined by James Galbraith, an economist and professor of public affairs and government at the University of Texas. His latest book is Inequality and Instability, a study of the world economy just before the Great Crisis. Hi, James. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much. Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Anat Admati. She's George Parker Professor of Finance and Economics at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford University, and she's co-author of the book, The Banker's New Clothes, What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It. Hi, Anat. Welcome back
Hello.
To the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have both of you. So, Anat, let's start off with you. I mean, when you look at news headlines, they just sort of contradict each other in many ways. The Christian Science Monitor says U.S. economy finally showing signs of growing more with less help. NBC stocks close at record highs. And then we have a lot of headlines saying that while the economy looks better, a lot of people feel like it's not working for them. So how would you describe the state of the economy today?
Well, I think what you're quoting is very telling, and the way you summarized it is also correct, that it depends on the measure you're using, and I think these measures can be very confusing. I think that the economy is not working for a lot of people, and I think some of these measures can be misleading, actually, so I would be cautious. My concern, and it's in the title of James' book, is about stability, and I think that part of what you're seeing in the stock market too is risk that could be building up still as the economy kind of tries to recover. So I think it's a very mixed picture that we have.
James, what is your reading of the economy and all of the good news that we often hear about?
Well, I don't see that the headlines are contradictory. It's the economy itself that has contradictions embedded in it. You have had a very good year for people who hold stock. Who owns corporate stock? Well, it's overwhelmingly concentrated amongst the wealthiest part of the population. That's where ownership is. The 48 million people you mentioned who are on food stamps and whose benefits are being cut do not own corporate stock, by and large. So we're looking at two aspects of a very complex phenomenon. One of the things that I think we tend to fall into with this kind of a trap is to believe that if we can get the stock market up, and the Federal Reserve does have tools, quantitative easing has worked in that direction on raising the value of existing assets, that this will flow automatically or in some direct way into improved job performance. And there's no real reason to believe that that's the case. We can do one thing. That doesn't mean you can do the other with the same tool.
So what would you say about the stock market? Because in every newscast, NPR to NBC, they always mention what's going on in the stock market. And David K. Johnston writes an opinion piece for Al Jazeera America saying that tech stocks have returned to bubble levels thanks to public relations, weak financial journalism, and cheap credit. He predicts that the market is actually going to collapse.
Well, it would not be the first time that that's happened. I find it, you know, an amusing feature of this, maybe not amusing, but an ironic feature of this, is that often in the same general discussion of things, you'll hear an optimistic report about the stock market and an alarmed report about another issue that you mentioned earlier, which is the rise of inequality in our society. But in fact, they're the same thing. They are exactly the same thing. Inequality goes up and sometimes comes down as a function of people's earnings from their capital asset holdings, which is corporate stock and realized capital gains and stock options realizations and IPO payouts from the initial public offerings and things of that nature. That's how the very rich get very rich and how they maintain their wealth. So they are, in fact, two manifestations of the same issue, but depending on how we describe it, we view one of them very positively and the other one as a source of concern.
And now, what would you add to that? I mean, when you talk to people about the stock market, and I really want to do a show about this because it was amazing to watch Twitter, which is based here in San Francisco. They got a payroll tax break to set up shop here. When they went public a couple months ago, they instantly created 1,400 millionaires. And David K. Johnston reports that Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg just unloaded 41.4 million Facebook shares for $2.3 billion, ensuring that even if the stock price collapses, he'll remain wealthy. You know, when you look at a company like Twitter, they've never turned a profit. So how do you explain how the stock market works?
Well, the stock market supposedly is about the future. I just want to make one more comment about sort of the past and about looking at stock market performance in the last year. Let's just remember, I didn't do that calculation, but, you know, if we're up in percentage term this past year, what does that do to how we were on trend, you know, from the 2000s, you know, the ups and the downs of all of this? In other words, we should look at a multi-year perspective in any case. If we just crashed and then we increased by many percentages, we might still not be back, even if we, you know, increased because it's a lot of percentages of a smaller number. So the way the percentages work, it's often misleading to say, oh, we had a record year, but we started the year so low, or we started the last few years with you crashed figures from the stock market, so we're barely recovering. So investors didn't do as well if you look at a longer horizon, even if they did well in the last year. Now, to your question about, you know, stock price valuations and bubbles and all of that, I mean, I teach some of this kind of stuff. Supposedly, you can have a high stock price because there's sort of expectations of future cash flows. We had companies, you know, in the stock bubble that didn't have earnings. I remember when Amazon went public, and that was unusual at the time. And of course, Amazon's very successful, or eBay, very successful, and others just went by the wayside. So it's basically kind of the investors trying to figure out who's going to be kind of, you know, the next Apple or the next Microsoft or Google or whatever. And so you get these valuations that seem to not make sense, and it's just a hard thing to think about. What's the value of a Twitter going out into infinity, you know?
And then what about economic growth, James? Because consumer spending accounts for about two-thirds of U.S. economic activity. And, you know, some people argue, especially around the holidays, isn't it great that people are buying so much stuff? This is great news for the economy. But David Lazarus in the L.A. Times writes that consumer debt is climbing at the fastest pace in more than 5 years. The American households are carrying about $113 trillion in debt. So can you explain that when we hear economic growth, especially around the holidays, when people buy stuff, what that means?
Well, for the last at least 30 years, economic growth and the growth of debt have gone hand in hand. And, of course, the latest manifestation of that on a really massive scale was the real estate boom and then debacle in housing finance that occurred 5 years ago. And that was a huge blow to the entire foundation of the American economy. So what you're talking about is, again, not at all contradictory. consumer spending is going to go up in an era when incomes are not growing very well, then very rapidly, then the debt will go up as well. And what that tells you is that this phenomenon may go on for a while, but it's not going. It's not something that's going to be sustained over anything that you'd call a long run. It will come to an end sooner or later. My own view on the matter, whether we're talking sooner or later, I tend toward the pessimistic side, maybe just a psychological disposition of my own. But when you look at what's happened recently and is happening recently in home sales, for example, I think there are reasons to think that some of the recent uptick will be followed by. Part of it may be revised out of the data, and part will be followed by a downturn. And there are pressures on people's incomes, which are coming from the fact that the federal budget continues to be squeezed by what we'll call the automatic stabilizers, tax revenues rising with growth, and what also by budget cutting is going to make it harder to keep any momentum going in the consumer sector for too long a time. Not to say that you might not get some more months out of it, or maybe a year or two, who knows, but it's not something which is being, which is going to be the foundation of a long boom.
What does that mean exactly? I mean, when you've got student loans hitting $1 trillion, auto loans are up, mortgage balances increased to $8 trillion in the third quarter, when you say that the end could be coming, what does that mean?
Well, people will borrow until they stop. Simple as that. And this is the way a credit cycle works. In the early phases, you get a kind of multiplicative effect. As people borrow, they spend, and other people's incomes go up, so they feel a little better, and they go out and they borrow a little bit more. And you get a rising trend of total expenditure and incomes. And at some point, what happens? It happens to every indebted homeowner and everybody who's got gets in too far on credit cards, and people realize that they've got too much debt, and they stop making any, first of all, their discretionary purchases. They make their cars last longer. They don't move to a bigger house, or they don't buy a house if they were planning to convert from being a renter. All kinds of things that can be deferred. And if things get worse than that, they cut into their basic standard of living until they can get their debts back down. And that's, of course, what we've been living through for the last 5 years. It's not entirely surprising that at a certain point, people get their debts down and then they begin to feel a little bit more relaxed about the situation. But, as I say, it is not a foundation for a long expansion, in my view.
That is James Galbraith. He's an economist and professor of public affairs and government at the University of Texas. His new book is Inequality and Instability, a study of the world economy just before the Great Crisis. We're also joined by Anat Admati, George Parker Professor of Finance and Economics at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford, and she's co-author of the book The Banker's New Clothes, What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It. And today it's our agenda for a new economy, and it's our open line to talk about the current state of the economy. If you have any questions about what we're currently facing, or if you'd like to talk about what your thoughts are on 2013 and all of these rosy headlines you're hearing in the news, what questions do you have and what are your thoughts on that? What do you see in your community in terms of how people are dealing with trying to find a decent paid job? What are you seeing in your community? What changes have you seen this last year? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. So, Anat, what does this all mean for people who are just trying to make ends meet? I mean, we'll talk about this during today's show, but between 2009 and 2013, low-wage jobs outnumbered high-wage jobs by about 800,000. And, you know, I mean, you talk to anyone who runs a food bank or a shelter, and they say that they just cannot keep up with demand.
Well, those things are very difficult to kind of figure out. how the economy works and how this inequality that James discusses has grown like this. I wanted to touch base again on the debt issue that you discussed just now, just to say there is this trend of the economy being more and more based on debt. Michael Lewis, in his book Boomerang, talked at the end about our reptilian brain, that we just have are tempted to just get money and spend it, and we're not sort of somehow our brain doesn't deal with excess of supplies of credit, and we love credit, and we all end up living on too much borrowed money. And of course, I trace that to the banks themselves sometimes overlending and underlending, and so there might be too much of certain kinds of credits that they give, and so people get into this debt spiral and borrow too much. We have some structural problems in the economy, and I think what you're seeing with the low wage jobs being so plentiful is there's all kinds of adjustments in terms of people's skills for jobs, and then the fact that the economy is slow, and therefore employers can get away with paying less for some of these jobs.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's hear from George in San Francisco. Hi, George. Welcome to the show.
Hi, and a Happy New Year to you, or a new calendar cycle, or whatever we're calling this.
Happy New Year.
One of the things that we always have an ongoing conversation and an argument going on at large, and various friends kind of looking at the future toward retirement. Mm-hmm. And you're thinking, okay, most of my gaining or income years are behind me, but I could retire. When should I retire? And suppose you put away a couple hundred thousand, not very much money, in various accounts, and you have a Social Security stipend coming in, or will be coming in when you retire, when you decide to claim it. And the question is, where can you put your money? Where can you move it that it will be relatively safe from fluctuations, from downward trends, from inflation? And you're not going to obviously speculate when you have a small amount of money. You want to try to conserve it. Do you have any suggestions for those of us who are thinking along those lines?
All right, thank you. James, any suggestions?
I'm not licensed to give advice on these matters, so I'll just say, Chinese real estate, how about that?
Anat?
Well, I want to make the same qualification. But I would mention, you mentioned being safe. Well, I mean, safe against price fluctuations in general, against inflation. If we thought there was inflation, there are this supposedly the safest investments are what's called TIPS. So those are kind of indexed bonds, and so they adjust themselves to price index. Right now, there isn't a high inflation, but interest rates will change. The difficulty right now, indeed, is that interest rates are punishing for savers. So they're meant to encourage more borrowing and more investment and to stimulate the economy. But that's how they, they say that they create these bubbles. But they do punish savers and people close to retirement because it's so hard to earn a safe return on savings. So it's very challenging.
Let me come back to the situation facing very large numbers of elderly and near-elderly Americans, which is not the problem that the caller has, but what to do when you don't have any savings at all. And maybe what you have is a home, and maybe the equity in that home isn't worth very much because of the collapse of value since the crash. So basically, you are living from day to day. What that means for about 40% of American elderly is that your major source of day-to-day income is going to be that Social Security check that the caller referred to. Mm-hmm. And that the adequacy of that check, it seems to me, is a worthwhile issue to raise. We have been subjected for a very many years to a barrage of propaganda about how we need to be cutting Social Security, somehow we can't afford it. This, I think the propaganda was well chosen. It is not, in fact, the case. The reality is that, as I say, a very large share of low-income elderly rely on that check. It would be sensible in the present environment to think about ways to make that check a little bit more generous. One way to do that is to help people who are obliged to retire at relatively early ages, at this early Social Security age of 62, and who take a steep discount from their lifetime retirement check when they do that. So the point I'm making is that thinking about how to make the larger population live at least a minimally decent life in their old age is very much dependent upon maintaining the adequacy of the public insurance programs that we have, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid being the three major ones that affect the elderly.
What are your predictions when you're thinking about people who are retiring? Because it's kind of incredible to think that 10,000 people turn 65 every day in this country. And as you said, James, about three quarters of Americans live paycheck to paycheck with little to no emergency savings. This is according to a survey by Bankrate.com. And there's a really great group in Boston called Hearth. And they're one of the few groups in the country that focus exclusively on the elderly homeless population. And they say that this country is just not prepared for what's to come. So is this something that you look at? What are your predictions for this population that is aging, and we're seeing so many of them?
Well, the most important way to help the low-income population that is preparing now, they're still working, but looking ahead, is to raise their wages. And we have a federal minimum wage, which is abominably low. Very low by historical standards, very low by comparison with other well-off countries. And I think it's dawning across the country now that the most important thing that we can do for the working population of this country is to raise that minimum wage. There is a federal bill which I think raises it to a still inadequate level of a little over $10. That may happen. But there's also an initiative to take it up to $12. And it may be something that California voters in particular may have a chance to vote on next November, because it may very well be a referendum item in California to establish a statewide minimum wage of $12. So Californians may have an opportunity to play a leadership role in something which would not only benefit the state of California enormously and people who work there, but also, as I say, provide an example which the rest of the country can be challenged to meet.
And now we've got about 30 seconds before break. Do you want to add anything there?
Well, to get the minimum wage, we need jobs, so we need the economy too. But I think that elderly population ideally would be helped by indeed the safety net, and maybe the new health care bill might help them when it works. And let me end there, since the 30 seconds.
Okay. That is Anat Admati. She's George Park Professor of Finance and Economics at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford. James Galbraith is an economist and professor of public affairs and government at the University of Texas. And this is Your Call. It's our Agenda for a New Economy show. It's our last show of the year, and we're opening the lines to take your questions about the economy. We do this maybe once or so a month, just to kind of talk about what's happening with the economy and what changes we would like to see. So we'd love to hear from you. We've got full lines. We'll have one open in just a couple of minutes. You can also send an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org, or leave a comment on our website. What are your thoughts about the economy in 2013, and what changes would you like to see next year? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
KALW, if you have a perspective that hasn't been heard yet in today's discussion, or a question you feel needs to be answered, please get in touch by calling 866-798-TALK. You can also email a question to, or comment, to feedback@yourcallradio.org. It's 10:30, coming up at 11 from the BBC. It's World Have Your Say, and then at noon following that, Philosophy Talk. Oh,
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will rebroadcast a conversation we had about restorative justice in schools. So be sure to tune in for that. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our Agenda for a New Economy series. We are opening the lines to take your questions and comments about the economy. We'll have one open in just a few minutes, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by James Galbraith, economist and professor of public affairs and government at the University of Texas. His new book is Inequality and Instability, A Study of the World Economy Just Before the Great Crisis. Anat Admati is George Parker Professor of Finance and Economics at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford, and she's co-author of the book, The Banker's New Clothes, What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It. And let's go to our next caller. Let's hear from Arnie in Oakland. Hi, Arnie. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking my call. I appreciate that very much, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment and just thank you for opening up the phone lines. And the big problem that we've come into is the pressure has come from being a global economy. And we've been sustainable as a nation for 200-plus years, and then we've gotten to this point where we're not sustainable as a nation because there's not enough fat to go around globally that was once there nationally. So when it comes to solutions, you have to go to simplicity for solutions, and you have to go to imagination, because imagination and nature is the key to all the answers there. So when you want to go from minimum wage to $8 to $12 an hour, it's not a solution, because the reality is wealth comes from investment. That's why you see people that come from third world countries and they've been here for less than 4 or 5 years, they become millionaires, because they realize these tools that you need to be sustainable. So when you get back to imagination, if you go to $12 an hour, you're going to put all these ma and pa businesses out of business, because if you ever had a lemonade stand or had a coffee shop, you'd realize you can't pay somebody $15 an hour to brew coffee or sell lemonade. You can't.
Well, okay, so let's stick with that, because that's a common, I don't know, can I call it a myth, James, that when the minimum wage goes up, mom and pops shut down? I mean, there have been a lot of studies that prove that's not true.
Well, let's get into the details of this. I mean, I think the caller is entirely right in that some businesses will suffer or will have to pay somewhat more for their labor. But what happens? You have a large population that gets a raise out of the minimum wage, a large population that retains their jobs and gets a raise. And those people have more purchasing power, and they come in through the front door with more money in their pocket. So the same population of small businesses gets a boost to its top line at the same time that it's getting something added to its expenses. Now, you have countries which have substantially higher minimum wages than we do. It's true, for example, in Australia, and it's true in a number of European countries. And Britain, for example, introduced a minimum wage, which had never had one before, in 1999, and has raised it up to, I think it's around $12 now. And so we have experiments with what happens to small businesses. And the answer is they don't go out of business. There is some change, as I say, in the structure of small businesses. One of the things that we have now is a population of small businesses that pay minimum wage. Many of these are large businesses, actually, with small franchise units, fast food chains, for example, that pay minimum wage or a little bit above, and then expect their workers to make ends meet with public assistance by going on food stamps, for example, or through the earned income tax credit. So you have corporations which are doing very well, thank you very much, because their workforce is getting welfare. And if you raise the minimum wage to, as I say, $12 an hour, one of the things happens is that the taxpayer is no longer paying, let's say, the part of the living expenses of the worker at, let's say, a place like McDonald's. That seems to me to be a very good thing. And if what happens is that people spend less money at McDonald's because their prices are a little bit higher, and more money at, let's say, restaurants of a slightly higher grade, that's also not a bad thing. And in fact, there are a lot of mom-and-pop shops that will come out as net gainers from that general situation. So this is a, this is something which has everything to do with the way in which we organize working relations in our society and with the kinds of businesses that will thrive. But it does not necessarily cut against the interests of small business in general. And I think that's, as I say, a fair and reasoned response to the concern the caller expressed, which I think I take seriously. It is something which a lot of people worry about. But when they do worry about it, I think they are looking at the cost side and not at what happens to, they're overlooking what is going to happen on the side of demand, on the side of the incomes of the working population.
And since we're talking about minimum wage and fast food workers, Anat, this year we saw a massive movement from fast food workers, Walmart workers, a lot of low-wage workers either going on strike or protesting for higher wages. Do you think that that will result in anything significant in 2014?
Well, I think that James talked a lot about minimum wage and the impact of that, which is kind of a complicated topic. I think that the concerns that is raised there, similar to concerns in Occupy Wall Street and others, is sort of a pent-up sense that something's wrong at that end. And I think that the notion that, you know, exactly how things should be organized, whether corporations should pay or businesses should pay higher salaries versus the safety net of taxpayers, which is squeezed on the other side, is something that's in play right now. I do want to go back to actually the caller started with a notion about global markets, and I just want to make one comment on that. I think it's a really good point to wonder about the sort of benefits and costs and sort of the impact of globalization and whether, you know, we've all benefited. On one hand, you know, free capital flows throughout the world, you know, could make a German retiree help fund, you know, housing in California or a municipality or whatever. And so we want the economy to be global. On the other hand, I think that we do have now a really complicated economy, and that these the globalization of it has also created risks and imbalances that we really, I think, policymakers are not appreciating and not thinking enough about, from the global monstrous banks to other issues about, you know, as the caller said, sustainability. So I think he's flagging a good problem here.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Arnie. Let's go next to John in El Cerrito. Hi, John.
Good morning. Hi, I'm a nurse at California Pacific Medical Center at the Pacific campus. We just recently voted to organize with the California Nurses Association, currently one of the last two hospitals in San Francisco that are still unorganized. I was just curious if your panel would please comment on the role of organized labor in the agenda for a new economy and perhaps bring up strategies that could be used to sort of regain what organized labor has lost in the last 30 years. Mm.
Well, and before we do that, John, what are your thoughts on that since you're on the ground?
I know that wages and benefits at hospitals that are not organized have not kept up with those where they are organized. Mm. I see that there is a transfer of wealth away from the middle class toward the elites. In the same time period, that organized labor has been on the decline. I wonder if there's a causal relationship there.
All right. Well, thank you. James, what are your thoughts on the role of organized labor?
It's organized labor has been one of the foundational institutions of our society and our economy. And what the caller says is perfectly correct. As it has declined, so too has the position of working Americans. We've also had an enormous change in the composition of the workforce, type of jobs that we have, which has made organization much more challenging for workers. It used to be manufacturing activity had maybe 30% of total employment 40, 50 years ago. And you can organize a factory, first of all, because all the workers are there in one place, and secondly, because when you set up a picket line, the factory stops, and you put a lot of pressure on the company to come to terms. And that's not the case for people who are working in a lot of decentralized retail units or in healthcare or in any number of other activities. So it becomes more challenging, and you have something that is sort of organized labor becomes more closely aligned with the low-wage labor that is not organized. Let me come back to this question of the minimum wage. What would be its effect on organized labor? If you really put it up into a decent living wage range of, let's say, the $12 an hour figure that I mentioned, one of the things that would happen would be that the gap between the wage paid to a unionized workforce and the wage paid at the bottom would shrink, right? Because you're raising the minimum relative to that. And that would make it less difficult. It would lower the resistance to unionization. And that would mean that employers who are more willing to accept unions would mean that workers who join unions would get some of the benefits that unions provide in terms of representation, in terms of grievances, in terms of job protection, in terms of having a proactive role in the way in which the workplace is organized. So I think as you come down to what could be done from a policy standpoint to assist the nurses of California who are not organized to join the ranks of those who are, this would, again, be a useful contribution. It's not the only thing that has to be done, but it would be something.
And Anat, what would you add to that?
I would add that unionization, to me, represents part of the sort of broader political problem, which is that we see in our democracies that sometimes the few can lose out on policy issues in general. And so it happens in a smaller scale in, you know, an employment relationship, but it also happens on a bigger scale when you move from Main Street to Washington, D.C. And I'm skipping Wall Street here, which is a player, of course, and I'm on that. But if you read about, you know, Washington, D.C. culture, you can see that sometimes there would be a disconnect because of campaign funding or because of the reasons where, you know, lobbyists can get things that, and the public doesn't always have lobbyists. So in that context, you can view a situation in which the interests of many sort of smaller part of the system individuals can get lost in organization or in government, and so in that sense, the role could be viewed as trying to aggregate and make more effective the impact of many voices versus the sum of the little parts.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, John. And today it's our Agenda for a New Economy series. It's our last show of the year, and we're opening the lines to take your questions and comments about the state of the economy and where we're going in 2014. We still have full lines, but we'll have a line open in a couple minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We're getting a couple emails actually about Social Security. A few listeners want us to do a show about the importance of Social Security and talk about why many Democrats are selling people out on this, especially some Democrats from California who have remained silent on this issue. So we'll definitely add that to the mix. Thanks for the email. Today we're joined by James Galbraith, an economist and professor of public affairs and government at the University of Texas. His latest book is Inequality and Instability, a study of the world economy just before the Great Crisis. And Anat Admati is George Parker Professor of Finance and Economics at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford. And she's co-author of the book, The Banker's New Clothes, What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It. And let's hear from Eileen in Mountain View. Hi, Eileen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having the show. My question is about the Fed buying securities from the banks, and the too-big-to-fail banks seem to be doing very well, thank you very much. And so they're going to cut down from $85 billion a month to $75 billion a month. I've never been quite clear exactly what they're buying, and I always think of it as the toxic assets, but maybe that's incorrect. But I'm wondering what you think the effect will be on the economy, pro and con, and what you think the effect on ordinary people will be. Thank you.
All right, thank you. James, do you want to take that one?
Okay. It's a tricky question.
Let me try this.
I think that the effect of the quantitative easing of the purchases has been to raise the price of certain assets, mostly U.S. Treasuries, but also qualified mortgages that the Fed has been taking onto its books, mortgage-backed securities. The Fed made a big noise in the summer about prospective tapering, and that kicked up the long-term interest rates and depressed those prices a bit. And so when it actually did it and made the announcement that it was going to taper its purchases by thus and such an amount, the extra effect of that was very minor. So my answer is that so far what you have already seen is most likely what you're going to get. I would not expect any major additional changes to, let's say, the structure of interest rates from the new initiatives or the initiatives that the Fed just recently announced. If big things started to happen, long-term interest rates really started to rise as a result of this, my guess is that the Fed would back off very quickly because it doesn't want there's no good reason for it to destabilize economic activity, and I suspect it doesn't want that to happen.
Anat?
Well, this quantitative easing thing the caller is wondering about, it did have the Fed kind of go in the markets and start buying mostly sort of treasuries. And then, of course, when you said the big banks are doing well, partly is everything that the Fed does goes through the banks. There's always, you know, stuff they take off the top. There's always some fees and other things from all of these operations. The problem is, as we've seen, a lot of what the central banks are trying to do, which is to meddle with certain prices, is having a hard time reaching the rest of the economy. And oftentimes it does appear that it helps first and foremost the banks, and they are kind of recovering better than everybody else. What they are buying does include these mortgage securities. So what, you know, the Fed does not buy, you know, directly stocks or other things. They somehow, by law, can only buy, you know, government bonds or they're allowing themselves to buy essentially, you know, mortgages through that are bundled together or whatever. So when they stop doing that, which they bought an enormous amount, I mean, we're talking trillions of dollars worth over these months, it's kind of scary because it's never been done before like that, and exactly how it's going to unwind, what's going to happen to interest rates. I think that it's a little bit scary to think. On one hand, we want interest rates to go up so that they pay savers. On the other hand, banks and other people in the economy might, you know, see prices of bonds go down. That's the way it works. Interest rates go up, prices of bonds go down. And so that's what killed savings and loans. That's what killed the big basic risk lurking there. So it's all very new and different, and I think the impact is yet to be seen of all of these.
I think the Fed wanted to be able to taper into a relatively strong moment of economic expansion, and so that there would be essentially no perceptible effect on the course of activity. And I suspect one of the things they found when they started making these noises last summer was that that wasn't the case, that the markets became really quite unstable for a short period, and they quickly backtracked and said, oh, well, we're not going to do it immediately, and now they're saying, well, we're going to do a little bit of this, of cutting back on our purchases. So my sense is and particularly with a new chair coming in Janet Yellen, who's a well-known figure in San Francisco, having been president of the San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank for many years, then I suspect that they will be proceeding really quite carefully. At least I hope they will. There's no reason for them to do anything that would be abrupt or disruptive, and it would be really quite a serious mistake if they did.
All right. Well, thank you for the question, Eileen. We have another question about the Fed. Let's hear from Jerry in Cupertino. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Good morning. Not being a conspiracy theorist, it just seems that the Fed and the government is basically saying, hey, we want everybody to invest in the stock market, so we're going to keep interest rates so low, I mean 0.01% or whatever I think is what the current banks provide, so that the only place you can put your money is in the stock market. And being an investor and going through the dot-com bust and going through the, you know, going through the subprime mortgage rate bust, every time I talk to my broker, it's like, well, we just lost 10 years worth of investment income because the market just cratered. And when do you see the market kind of, when do you see things getting to the point where investments you can have savings instead of investments? It seems like the government is basically forcing you into the stock market, whether you like it or not, because the only other place you can keep your money is under the mattress.
All right. Anat, do you want to take that one?
That's exactly why the connection is made between these low interest rates and kind of stock bubbles and other things, which is sort of where we started the program. And as the caller is saying, you know, you can't save safely, and it came up again in the program. Mm-hmm. And so, if you want to make return, you have to take risk. And the starting point of any return is kind of what you call the riskless rate, and that is essentially zero right now. So it's like under the mattress. So savings versus investment, I think the distinction was made: risky investment versus, you know, investing, saving at a safe rate, somehow that is somehow okay, good enough for saving. Of course, it has to also do with the prices and whether prices are changing. If you're getting interest rate of 10%, but there's inflation, then it's not that much. So we want to keep up with the standard of living. But yes, I think that the caller is bringing up a point about the fact that there's sort of the yield chasing going on when interest rates are very low, and that can fuel risky investments and maybe the taking of too much risk by people. And I think that's a concern that sometimes the Fed expresses, but then it's like they kind of see no choice but to live with that somehow. The way I want them to deal with it first and foremost is to make sure that that the banks themselves, that are kind of at the center of intermediation, are not themselves taking too much risk, and I think they are. So not necessarily in their investment, but in the way they fund themselves.
All right. Well, thanks for calling, Jerry. We've had full lines the whole show. I mean, people really want to talk about these issues. Alicia in Berkeley couldn't stay on the line, but this is a good last question. What would a sustainable economic growth pattern be based on? James, how would you answer that?
On very strong community social insurance, on the protection of the weakest and most vulnerable people in the country, and on a decent level of wages for those who are at the bottom of the pay scale. When you do those things, then you're much closer to sustainability, because you're not pushing as large a part of the population off the cliff. Mm. That's what I would be focused on first and foremost.
And in order to get there, what policy changes would you like to see?
Oh, well, to begin with, I would like to see the higher minimum wage. I would like to see a modest strengthening of, of Social Security. I would like to see the successful implementation of the Affordable Care Act with reasonable controls over the growth of health care costs. I would like to see an extension of unemployment insurance immediately. There are a whole range of things that are actually existing programs which are under threat and which should be protected and strengthened. That's, I think, again, where I put my immediate first priority.
And not 30 seconds, what would you add to that?
I would add to that I want to focus on having everybody work productively, and that's what would put the economy back on its feet, having sort of sound, resilient sort of ways to fund good investments for people to get education and for people to work productively. That's the growth that would be best for everybody.
Anat Admati is George Parker Professor of Finance and Economics at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford, co-author of the book The Banker's New Clothes, and James Galbraith is an economist and professor of public affairs and government at the University of Texas, author of Inequality and Instability. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you. Happy
Pleasure.
New Year.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. Happy New Year. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How is restorative justice affecting troubled students? On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast a conversation about restorative justice in schools. Last year in Oakland, where the majority of suspensions were African-American students, the school district turned to restorative justice as a way to resolve conflict and decrease suspensions. How are these programs being used to teach kids alternatives to conflict and help keep them out of prison and in school? That's on the next Your Call with Hannah Baba and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.